Case number 21-3032. United States of America versus Theodore B. Douglas, appellant. Mr. Axum for the appellant, Mr. Hansford for the appellee.
Good morning, Mr. Axum.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Tony Axum representing the appellant, Theodore Douglas. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Police did not have reasonable suspicion to stop Mr. Douglas. Mr. Douglas's objectively innocent conduct was not of a nature that created reasonable suspicion. And it did not match conduct that the observing officer, Officer Jackson, based on his knowledge and experience, said typically met reasonable suspicion standard, giving rise to a belief that criminal activity was afoot. The facts in this case individually were entirely innocent, and collectively, even when combined with the high crime nature of the area, did not rise to the level of reasonable suspicion. Mr. Douglas was on a sidewalk, open to the public in the middle of the afternoon on a sunny day, which itself was not unusual or suspicious. Officer Jackson testified that he saw someone walk up to him with a bag, and the bag didn't come from anywhere hidden. It was openly displayed. Officer Jackson could describe the bag, and the person handed the bag to Mr. Douglas, who openly accepted it. The bag itself was not a container that was associated with illicit transactions, but was a small, fancy leather backpack. And Mr. Douglas took the backpack and placed it on his back. And I realize that it's referred to as a backpack the entire time, but Government Exhibits 4 and Defense Exhibit 4 show that it's not actually a backpack with two straps on the side. It's a backpack with a cross strap. And I point this out because it might not fit easily on the back over the coat. It makes it understandable that Mr. Douglas took his coat off, put the strap on, cross. I mean, obviously, this is not captured on the body-worn camera. It's not described by Officer Jackson, but the government exhibits demonstrate that the strap is across, which might not be comfortable to go across the zipper of the coat if you want to unzip the coat. It's also understandable that in a high-crime area that Mr. Douglas would wear something that he doesn't want others to see under his clothes, or something that may appear valuable to others out of sight.
So let me ask you a question. Given your position about innocent conduct and basically entrapment, would you take the same position were we to accept your description of what the officer saw, but that given his experience, there was a ground to approach Mr. Douglas and his companion and ask some questions?
Your Honor, police always have the right to approach a person on the street just as any citizen can and ask questions. And
precisely.
That's what the police should do if they do not actually have reasonable suspicion but want more information. And that, of course, is not what happened here.
Well, what I'm getting at is, I'm not sure it technically, and maybe you're more familiar with I than the law in this area, technically entrapment, but because the two men voluntarily went into this, I'm going to describe it as an alley, you say it's the sidewalk, and this officer saw conduct that was consistent with the type of conduct where he had previously indicated that there was exchange of illegal drugs or some other illegal activity. So I'm just wondering, where is it that you think the line was crossed? Is it when the arrest team came and pushed him against the wall and, you know, crossed his hands and put the handcuffs on?
No, Your Honor, I'd say in terms of the Fourth Amendment, there was not reasonable suspicion to actually stop him. So, not even to stop.
I thought you agreed the police could say to the two men, hey, guys, I'd like to ask you some questions. Will you just stop a moment?
I don't think there's anything wrong with the police approaching someone and asking questions or and asking them to stop and answer those questions.
Right. But, so that's my point. I just want to understand under that scenario, what is the action that was taken by the by anyone of the officers that crossed the line?
Well, I'd say first, the first officer to reach my client walked up to him and immediately touched him. And touching a defendant is a touchstone of seizure. I mean, it is once he touched him, he was seized. So that was that took it past a consensual encounter of simply asking questions.
Let me ask you, in all due respect, that's a very broad reading of when an arrest occurs. If I just, the officer just tapped me on the arm and said, could I ask you some questions? Here there was a push against the wall, I realize, but given that guns are everywhere, and this officer who called in the arrest team, and presumably the arrest team even knew the alley had a reputation for a place where illegal transactions occurred.
Well, can I address, I'd ask the court to look carefully at the exhibits submitted, both the pictures and the digital exhibits. It's not actually an alley. It is a sidewalk. It's a walkway. There is a fence on one side. There is grass on either side behind the fences. And then there are apartment buildings. So this
what
is
what information did the officer
get at it that they were out of the general public view that you would be in were you out on what I'm referring to a sidewalk?
I take issue with that. And that's why I can only refer to the record evidence. And the observing officer is parked in a car on the street. So that fact alone establishes that they were not out of public view. This isn't an alley. It's not a cul-de-sac. It is a walkway from one street to a parking lot on the other side. And it is open. The buildings, you can look down. I don't want to argue on this point,
Mr. Axum. I don't think this is key to your argument, but I just want to understand where the line is crossed in your view.
Well, I think the line is crossed.
The initial touch by a member of the arrest team.
I think at the point that my client is touched, he seized. But I think that the touch is escalated when the officer immediately puts handcuffs on him, and it only escalates from there. There are several frisks. There's accusatory questioning, and he's led away. There are officers on both sides. There's an overwhelming show of force by multiple officers.
Did the government contest that there was a seizure from essentially the moment that the officers encountered him?
I don't think the government questions that it was a seizure from the outset of contact with.
What information did the officers who conducted the two officers who were first on the scene
the uniformed officers who conducted the frisk, what information did they
have? The only information they had was what they had been told by...
Well, that's the question. What were they told by Officer Jackson?
According to Officer Poupart, he was not told anything except to stop this individual, person in the blue jacket.
He just gave them a description of who they were without any other information? Or is that clear on the record? It's not clear to me. I may be missing something.
I'm not sure. I could take a moment and
let me tell you why I'm asking this. As I recall, there is a doctrine under the Fourth Amendment and also under Torrey versus Ohio that the officer who conducts the frisk, conducts the search, if that officer receives information from another officer and the officer that conveys the information may be mistaken, that nevertheless, the search is valid if the information that the searching officer gets would justify the search. I haven't stated it very well. But
yes, I'm familiar with that line of cases, but that line of cases deals specifically with warrants and information contained in databases that is sometimes not accurate. License revocation.
Has it ever been applied in a Terry versus?
I'm not aware of it ever being applied in a Terry situation.
It's never been rejected, though.
It hasn't been rejected, but there would be very good reason for rejecting it because it would essentially create a good faith exception to officers' observations in the field. So if they thought they saw something and the objective facts revealed that they did not see that, as long as they thought they saw it, their good faith reliance on what they believed at the time would sustain a Fourth Amendment violation. Fourth Amendment the Fourth Amendment itself can't sustain good faith exception for officers' observations in the field. Terry and really every significant Fourth Amendment decision goes directly to what are the objective facts, not what did the officer believe or how did the facts appear? The question is not, did it appear to be money? The question is whether it was money. And I'd suggest to the court, that's the only way that the court, after the fact, outside of the heat of the moment, fashion neutral evaluation of the situation, can only look at the objective facts.
So one thing that, troubles me about this case, and I'm going to ask your friend on the other side this, is Government's Exhibit 3 is the radio communication. And the officer, I believe his name, Jackson.
That's correct.
Who was undercover and did the observation. You know, he posted the lookout and the description of the people he wanted to be stopped, that he saw, you know, undertake this hand-to-hand exchange he thought might have been a drug transaction. And then he says he needed the officers to check that book bag for him, essentially giving them a directive that's what he wants. He wants the book bag to be checked out. And the reason that alerted me is because, you know, as the Supreme Court has said in many cases, including New Jersey v. TLO, the whole purpose of the Fourth Amendment was because the framers were concerned in rejecting the, you know, pre-revolutionary practice of having soldiers without any sort of warrants or judicial supervision undertaking searches. In here, it wasn't the directive to stop these people, question them, see if you can learn anything that would either confirm or dispel the suspicion that there was an illegal transaction, it was, I want you to stop them and check that book. So when do officers without warrants get the authority to just tell other officers to go essentially search a book bag, search first or other container that someone on the street is carrying?
I don't think there's any authority for that. There's certainly no authority under Terry to immediately search a container that someone is carrying. And I think the officer's actions in this case bear out that they were there to search the book bag. Officer Poupart, through a series of escalating like intrusions into, and Officer Taylor, series of escalating intrusions into my client's personal space and personal property, walk up to him immediately, like start squeezing his back. It's not what you would picture a typical frisk. They don't start at the top and move around. They both immediately go to the back, just as they were instructed to by Officer Jackson. That, we submit, was closer to a search at the very outset. But they don't stop it at squeezing, manipulating, and trying to figure out everything in the bag. Officer Poupart and Jackson take additional steps. Officer Poupart at one point asks for consent to search the bag. They unzip Mr. Douglas's coat. They pull the coat down over his arm. These are not minor indignities. This is a full-on search. The Fourth Amendment simply doesn't allow that process. I mean, to Judge Rogers' point, it would allow them to walk up and try to dispel any suspicion that they may have. While we're submitting that the facts in this case don't establish even the minimum of suspicion, officers blow right past that point and are into a full-on search. To go back to where Officer Poupart is after he has unzipped my client's bag, my client's coat, and has been denied permission to search the bag, he then waits again for some other authorization from someplace else. You can tell on the radio. I think it's a fair assumption that it's Officer Jackson saying, yes, unzip the bag. And he unzips the bag. So he's being directed by Officer Jackson.
No, it shows that he's feeling around in the bag before he unzips it. And the video indicates that he found something.
That's correct. Bag,
right?
That's correct. But even within the context of Terry and a frisk, officers are allowed to frisk, but not to frisk, to search. And
well, the feeling of a hard object with a barrel and a handle on it is what the testimony was. It gave him probable cause to open the bag. That wasn't part of the frisk. Once he felt that, then there certainly was probable cause. You would not deny that, would you?
If that is indeed what he felt.
What you have to argue is he was not entitled to even pat or feel the bag. That's got to be your argument. Once he does that and feels the outline of a gun in there, he's got probable cause.
Well, I think there are two aspects to frisking. I mean, one is the actual frisk, and two is feeling the outline of a gun. You're to frisk to rule out that there are not weapons. You're not supposed to frisk to search to figure out everything that is in the bag. And by Officer Poupart's own testimony, he testifies that he's trying to articulate what is in there. He is trying to palpitate what is in there to figure out. Those are his words, to figure out what is in there. That is a search. That is not, I am patting him down to rule out that he has a weapon. He does not actually testify that I felt a heart.
I'm not sure there's no gun in there.
I'm sorry?
I mean, that happens in every frisk, that where they feel in the pockets and in the belt and so on to make sure there's no weapon there.
That's
what he's doing.
That's correct. But again, this is not a pocket. This is not something against the body of the person. It is a bag.
And yeah, I understand.
And what he is describing is manipulating the objects in the bag, to figure out what they are. That is a search. And I understand that it is a small distinction, but it is a significant one in the Fourth Amendment context. Because if every time an officer stops someone with a bag, they can methodically
Let's just be clear, though. You're not arguing, at least I don't believe I saw it in your argument, that you can't, that a bag is outside the scope of risk.
I'm not arguing that a bag is outside the scope of a frisk. If, for example, Officer Hupart had said, I felt something hard and wanted to figure out what it was, that's different. But he feels outside of the bag. He feels something that he says seemed to be a glasses case. And I continue to articulate what else was in there. At that point, he has not said, I figured out there was a gun in there. He doesn't put his hands on the bag and say, aha, there's a gun. That's not his testimony.
He doesn't have to say that as long as he has some cause to believe it may be a gun. That's what probable cause means.
But his testimony has to be that I thought it was a gun. I mean, that if to get to probable cause,
I thought it might be a gun.
I wanted to figure out everything was in there.
Probable cause means it's sufficient if he says, I thought it might be a gun. That's enough.
Well,
why don't you wrap up? We'll give you some time on rebuttal.
I suppose that takes me to the third argument that I raised, which is if Officer Hupart thought it was a gun, he did not react in a way that suggested that. It's our position that he did not, and it's inherently incredible that he believed that he was touching a gun and he continued to squeeze it for so long that he did not immediately seize it. If he thought he had probable cause to seize it, he didn't need to ask Mr. Douglas, may I have for permission to go into the bag? He didn't need to call radio in for further permission from Officer Jackson to go into the bag. I'd submit that looking at Government Exhibit 4.
We'd have to find that the district court findings otherwise were clearly wrong.
Yes, this court would have to be left with a definite and firm conviction that the findings were clearly erroneous, that and I'd submit they are so inconsistent with what we would expect from a police officer and human nature and knowledge that they are.
All right. We have your argument. We'll hear from you on rebuttal. Mr. Hansford.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Eric Hansford for the United States. Each of the defendants' three arguments for suppression fails in this case. First, the district court correctly concluded that when an experienced undercover officer who was operating in a block known for drug trafficking saw the defendant engage in a hand-to-hand transaction and then saw him immediately and hurryingly hide the backpack he'd just gotten underneath his jacket, the police had reasonable suspicion to stop the defendant for investigation. Second, this was a Terry stop and not an arrest. The police specifically told the defendant they were stopping him as part of an investigation for a minute, and the officer's on-the-ground decision to use handcuffs in this case was reasonable. Even if the handcuffing had been unreasonable, that would not be a ground for suppression. And third, the defendant fails to show clear error in the district court's credibility findings on the scope of the search, and instead the body-worn camera is very much consistent with the testimony about the scope of the search.
Let's start with your first argument, the first issue. Officer Jackson testified at, was it a preliminary hearing?
He testified both at a preliminary hearing, but the suppression hearing is what is really here.
Because the testimony that seemed to be cited in the district court's order was from the preliminary hearing, I thought.
I don't think that's correct. I think it's from a suppression.
But at any rate, the testimony that was cited, at least what I read, said that he did not know whether what was exchanged for the bag was money, some light colored object that could be money but may not have been money. And then, of course, no money was found on the gentleman that he had the hand-to-hand exchange with, right?
So no money was found, but both the testimony of the officer and the district court's findings are that it appeared to be. So on A247, the officer says, the undercover officer says, it appeared to be the exchange of U.S. currency. And on A159, in the district court's opinion, it says that Williams handed, the other person handed Douglas the backpack, quote, in exchange for what appeared to be money. So that's both in the district court opinion and the officer's testimony. And that is very much consistent more broadly with how
there was cash recovered from Douglas, wasn't it?
No cash was recovered from Williams, meaning the person.
But there was cash. Yeah, there was cash recovered from Douglas.
I do not recall if there was cash recovered from Douglas, but I think in terms of the lack of recovery of money, it was, and the district court addresses this in its opinion, Williams saw Douglas get searched, and then Williams continues.
So the reason I'm asking that question is it clear that whatever was exchanged was something Douglas gave Williams, or was it the other way around? Or could they not tell what was going on?
So the undercover officer's testimony is that Williams, who's dismissed, gives the backpack to Douglas. Douglas then gives back a small light-colored object that the officer testifies appears to be money. But the lack of money recovered in this case, the district court says, Williams sees
the result. I read the district court's findings different. I read that the district court found that there was a hand-to-hand transaction. The district court found that Jackson believed that it was currency. But that's, I'm not sure what that gets you. He might have believed that it was currency, but he testifies under oath that he couldn't really see what it was, but he believed because there was an exchange that it was likely currency.
So
that's a hunch.
So it's two answers to that. First, it's not a hunch. He describes, based on the size, the color, how it's being handled, why it is he believes it's currency. And that's in footnote 5 of our brief. That's collecting all those record sites. But the more important point, I think, is that the key is that there's an exchange, that it's not just someone receiving an object. So what this court says in Johnson is receiving an object has many innocent explanations. But this court in Johnson specifically says there was not an item exchanged in that testimony, in that very sentence, where the court is saying receiving an object has many innocent explanations. So this was a hand-to-hand transaction, just as the undercover officer testified he was looking for. And then on top of that, we have to look at the totality of the circumstances. So the Wesby rejects the sort of divide-and-conquer approach to looking at each factor individually and trying to determine whether or not we can provide an innocent explanation for each one. We have to look at the full picture. So what we have is that this is a block that's known for drug trafficking, a sidewalk where the undercover officer himself has seen prior drug deals. He sees the hand-to-hand transaction he's looking for, and then he sees Douglas make this suspicious movement of hiding the backpack underneath his jacket.
But I have not seen a case from our circuit where the object that is exchanged, even if we assume that it was some sort of reasonable belief that what he saw, Douglas hand money to William, the object that he got in return in that exchange was a bag. It wasn't packaged like anything that, small baggies or anything like resembling drugs. He had no prior knowledge about either of these individuals. So the prior knowledge that he had was of the neighborhood. and what occurred in the neighborhood. So it seems to me that we would be breaking new ground to say that this is reasonable, articulable suspicion to walk up to somebody in broad daylight who's in a public area after making an exchange where you can't even be sure that it's currency, but you see someone hand someone something and get handed something back. And it's a bag that they put on and then they put their coat on over it. And we're going to assume that that's concealment, even though furtive gestures is only credited when it's furtive because you're trying to hide something from someone you know to be police. But this was an undercover. And so they weren't trying to hide anything from the police. So we're going to break new ground and say that you can just walk up to somebody and then handcuff and detain them based on that.
So I think there was a lot in that question, and I want to kind of make 3 points. I don't think this would be breaking new ground. I think specifically the Green case that we cite in the briefs from this court finds probable cause in very similar circumstances.
There's a lot more in Green.
There is more in Green, but it's also probable. Well, I'm not sure there is a whole lot more in Green, but there is. We agree there's more in Green, but it's also a much higher standard of probable cause. This is a reasonable suspicion. The question is whether the police can stop the person just to investigate what's going on.
Well, so, they were told, I want you to check that bag.
So
that's what the directive was. You agree with that, right?
So I do not agree with that, but so Your Honor,
I didn't hear that on the tape. Do you want me to tell you where that is on the tape?
So I think there were a number of questions about reasonable suspicion. If I could address those before we go to the scope of the frisk, because this court also
was it a frisk? It goes to the question of was this a frisk or was this stop him so you can check the bag?
So I'm happy to address the frisk, but I do have the court asked me a number of questions, including about furtive movements that I do want to be able to address. The questions about whether or not furtive movements or concealment can be considered absent the police involvement. The Green case specifically says, it's another undercover officer case, specifically says when the people are concealing the object that is being exchanged, that is something that provides the police with suspicion. That's one of the key Green factors that it cites. And that's an undercover officer case that is not in response to police presence. And so
if somebody gets something and they put it in their pocket, that's concealment?
No, Your Honor. It's all
kind of, well, they're hiding it. So every time someone puts something somewhere where it can't be seen, that's suspicious concealment.
No, Your Honor. But so you have to look at the circumstances and whether or not it looks like they're hiding something or they're not. So in this case, what the officer describes is that he takes off the jacket hurriedly, he puts the backpack on, then puts the jacket over it. I think this court is supposed to use its common sense in trying to assess whether or not that's suspicious. The officer testifies that it is suspicious to him, the experienced undercover officer. And that is very similar to what this court found in Green was suspicious and helped provide the reasonable suspicion. I think it's also, I'll cite the Supreme Court's Cibron case, which is the Terry companion cited in the reply brief. There, the court cites furtive tiptoeing in an apartment hallway. And that is, I think, actually the source of the furtive movements or furtive actions kind of case law. That is not in response to police presence. That's just
I was a public defender for 10 years, and there are a lot of people who I represented in their families and lived in neighborhoods like this and made way worse neighborhoods than this. And they did things that were a little different than the way you and I might do. They did things like, you know, guys didn't carry wallets because the wallet was just a convenient compartment for a robber to steal all of their money. Instead, they hid their money. Women hid their money in their bra. If they wore a purse, it was a very small purse that they could put underneath a jacket so they couldn't be seen. That's another consequence of living in a high crime.
Sure, I do.
That's why I'm asking you these questions about concealment.
Of course, Your Honor. And I understand that there could be innocent explanations, especially when you're taking the factors one by one. But the question here, it's far less than preponderance of the evidence. It's less than probable cause. It's just whether or not the police can stop the person to investigate what's going on. And here we do have very good record evidence from the undercover officer that he's looking for this sort of hand-to-hand transaction. He describes the backpack transfer as being consistent with this bulk narcotics or firearms transactions. He's looking for people to hide as part of these hand-to-hand transactions, to hide what they're doing, consistent with what this court said in Green. And so we do have the record evidence.
Where was Williams carrying the backpack? Did he have it on his, was he carrying it by hand or was it on his back?
He was just carrying it by hand, was the record evidence in terms of that. Yeah. Your Honor, you also asked about the frisk here. The testimony or the undercover officer saying to check the bag, I don't think that's cited in the briefs or suggested that that's kind of the reason for the frisk. My recollection, so I haven't specifically reviewed that part of the.
It's in Government's Exhibit 3.
That's
the
true.
Radio communication.
Yes, Your Honor.
That you put in the evidence, your government right. put in evidence.
So all I'm saying is that my recollection is that comes after the frisk. It may be wrong because I haven't specifically checked that because I don't think that was an argument that was made. But my recollection is
that Officer Jackson said that after the frisk had occurred.
That is my recollection in this case. But I think the more important question is that what we're operating on is objective standards, not subjective standards. And this frisk in this case was proper. As Judge Randolph was saying, they feel an L-shaped object in the backpack. Indeed, if you look, especially at Government Exhibit 4, but if you just look at Appendix Page 150, which is a still photo from the body-worn camera, you can see the L-shaped outline of the hard object at the very outset of the frisk.
Which exhibit is this?
This is, I believe it's 4, but it's A150 in the appendix. Appendix page 150 is where you see that. You can see it better in the video where he's moving the object and you can see this whole L-shaped move. But that is where you're seeing. And more importantly, I think the question is not whether the body-worn camera definitively proves what the officer is saying, but whether the officer does testify that he feels this hard object and recognizes it as a gun in the very first seconds of this frisk. We collect the kind of sites on page 7 of our brief. And so the officer is testifying that he knows almost from the outset that he has a gun in this case. And so at that point, the officer is free to squeeze the object to make sure that it is a gun. As long as he's looking for a weapon, he is free to do those things. And so that does not go beyond the scope of the frisk. I think this court.
So you would say that distinguishes this from Minnesota v. Dickerson, where the officer squeezed the bag and continued squeezing, not because the officer thought that there was a weapon, but because the officer just wanted to figure out what was in the bag.
That's correct. And this court in Johnson specifically says, the limitation imposed by Dickerson is that once the officer finds an object on the person of a suspect, he may not palpate it more than is necessary to determine whether it is a weapon. As long as he thinks he has a weapon, he is allowed to determine if it's a weapon and to take the weapon to disarm the person who he's stopping for officer safety. I mean, that's what happens in Terry. Holmes from this court stands for that proposition as well. The Dickerson issue is when you go beyond looking for a weapon, when you have an object you know is not a weapon, you are continuing to search. That's when there's an additional search. That's when there's a problem.
So one of the questions here, isn't it, that most of these cases occur where the outline or the hard object that seems to be a gun is on the physical person of the defendant, not in a separate bag that would have to be unzipped for the person carrying the bag to actually take it out and threaten the officers. So what do you do with that fact?
So I think there are two parts of that. One is that I understood from Mr. Axum's argument earlier that he's not disputing that part of the permissible frisk was searching the backpack in this case.
I wanted to ask my question, answer my question.
Sure. So what we have here is that the defendant, he's wearing the backpack and it's under his jacket. So if you watch the body-worn camera, there's not like a, it's not like there's a separate bag that they are kind of feeling that could be easily separated from the defendant. He's wearing the backpack underneath his
jacket. Protect the officer. All he needs to do is take the bag under your presentation. There's no reason to open the bag.
I think the invasiveness of taking the bag would be more than just frisking the defendant. Because the bag is under the jacket, in order to take the bag, they would have to unzip the jacket, take off the backpack.
The physical difficulty of the defendant threatening the officer with the gun, unless he takes several steps. Either he has to, as you say, take off his jacket, then he has to take off the bag, then he has to unzip the bag. Most of the cases don't present this type of obstacle to getting to the source of what may endanger the investigating officer.
So I think I think that's kind of looking at it from hindsight.
Off of the arresting officer knew that what he felt was under the jacket in a bag. So that's not after the fact. It's what he was presented with the facts. And you do not want to acknowledge what's in the government exhibit about the instruction from Jackson was to check the bag. That's very different than the Terry stop for purposes of investigation, where the officer can take reasonable steps to protect himself from injury or something like that.
So what the officer testifies here is in the first 5 seconds or in the first few seconds of frisking the defendant, he feels this gun. He feels this gun immediately. And so I'm not sure if the court is asking about that initial feeling of the gun or if the officer can take
Terry. And what the Supreme Court Terry was concerned about, and what most of our cases, and you haven't cited one that I'm aware of, are concerned about officer safety in approaching a defendant. So here, Jackson didn't say, I think there's a gun in the bag. He said, search the bag.
So we do not think
distinction between those facts and the usual facts where the defendant who is being investigated by the police in this Terry context has ready access to a weapon.
So this court's cases do not require the police officer to figure out exactly how easy a weapon that's on his body is going to be.
Take the hypothetical. I have it in a locked bag. I can't get to it. The officer can't get to it until I unlocked the bag. And essentially, it's locked here to the extent that the officer knows it's under the jacket. So it's unavailable to the defendant until he takes off the jacket. And then because whether it's described as a backpack or a cross strap bag, he has to take that off too. And I think talk about objective facts and totality of circumstances. I don't think you can ignore that. You have to come to deal with it. And plus your own exhibit directing the officer to check the bag.
So two things. One, Mr. Axum, I believe, just conceded that that it's okay for the police to be frisking the bag, that is permissible.
I wish you would deal with my questions, right?
Because sure.
What I'm dealing with is what the Supreme Court was concerned about, namely officer safety. And so protective searches, protective frisk, you know, taking the totality.
So the case law, I'm sorry, Your Honor. So the case law says if a person has a weapon on them or indeed ready access to a weapon.
Those cases are not talking about a defendant having to basically unlock the object in which there may be a gun.
So here the object was not locked and the officer...
This is an easy answer.
I know.
The answer is what is the officer, when the officer feels something through the coat and in the backpack, what's he supposed to do?
Right.
Say, oh, sorry, I bothered you. Unleash the handcuffs and let him walk away. I mean, it would be a dereliction of duty for him not to investigate further.
Question is whether he had the duty to undertake that in the first. Let me ask you this question. What is the evidence as to whether they frisked his person and when they frisked his person?
So, meaning the rest of his body.
What normally happen in a stop and frisk situation where you frisk the person, you pat them down.
So
they ever pat him down, and if so, when?
I believe they do, and I think it's in Defense Exhibit 4, which is the partner's video. I think she is searching the front of him, but I think the officer immediately feels the gun. Once he feels the gun, you can see he's tightened his grip on the defendant.
Because the first thing that he does is handcuff him, pull the jacket down, and start filling the backpack.
No.
Well, he doesn't pull the jacket down for a couple of minutes. Right. He leaves the jacket. The jacket is up for the first couple of minutes. The first thing he does is he pulls him over, and then he starts frisking his back. And within seconds of starting to frisk his back, he feels the gun. And again, you can see this in the body. And this is also what the district court's findings are. This is how the officer...
One of the photographs shows
that. That's right. That's A150. Appendix page 150 shows that gun. So what the officer's doing is he starts the frisk with the back. He immediately feels a weapon. At that point, the defendant, I think as Mr. Axum, you know, the defendant is not going to be released until the officers recover that weapon in this case. But the officers are allowed to go in and to recover that weapon once they feel a gun in his back.
All right. Any other questions, Judge Rogers?
No, thank you.
Judge Randolph?
No.
Yes, this court to affirm.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hansford. Mr. Axum, you didn't have any time. We'll give you 2 minutes.
I take that time to refer the court to what Officer Jackson said, and that he may have at some point said something appeared to be money, but that was explored further on cross-examination, and that is what is supposed to happen. You're supposed to figure out what exactly the officer is saying. What do the words appear to mean? And Officer Jackson conclusively explained that he did not know what he saw. He was too far away. He couldn't tell it was money. He couldn't even tell if it was paper. So that is at 299, A299, A278. And I think that's conclusive. With regard to concealment, concealment itself is a generic act. We conceal things. I conceal putting my pin in my mouth. That is a generic act. And because when you have something that is generic and ubiquitous everywhere, people conceal things all day, as is their right under the Fourth Amendment, as the court points out, in order to attach some criminal motive to it, the police have to explain why. And that did not occur here. The officer didn't say, I've seen people who are selling drugs get a backpack and put it under their coat. That's their MO. He didn't do that. So the government, if that was the telltale sign of a drug transaction, should have elicited that testimony from the officer. They didn't, because it's not, because concealment is a general act. And even the concealment in Green that the government relies on very strongly, it's concealment of drugs. They are at sight. You can identify them. The concealment here is of a bag, something that is innocent of itself. So it makes sense that you would try to conceal something that everyone knows already is criminal. The other thing about Green that I'd point out is that there was currency, paper U.S. currency in Green. So it was an exchange of something, small objects, presumably drugs, or paper U.S. currency. So Green is not on all fours with this case. That is simply inaccurate. The other thing that I want to say, the government keeps referring to a concession. When I concede, I will say I concede. I have not conceded. I admit that I did not raise a challenge to the search of the bag as part of as a separate search from the frisk. But I do not concede. I want that to be very clear. The last thing that I would refer to is Officer Poupart and his testimony. And I refer the court to A380, where Officer Poupart is asked, now, when Mr. Douglas says it's a glasses case, at that point in time, you also agree there is at least a glasses case in there. Yeah, or a similar object. What you are trying to figure out is if there is something else in there. The answer, right, if there is something else in there. By Officer Poupart's own admission, he did not know whether there was something else in there. He was trying to figure out whether there was something else in there. That is a search. At the moment he is trying to figure out and not patting down and immediately realizing that it is a gun, it is a search. And it is beyond the scope of Terry and required probable cause.
Thank you. We have your argument. We'll take the case under advice.